Hello and welcome to Volume 44, Number 32 of your weekly local news magazine, Grapevine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 9th of August 2024. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by newsreader Andy. And in this week's issue, the Shrubland Centre celebrates, Storm Debbie could be bringing the heat, Hemsby's public loo Ferrari, and forget the saying, Fritton is the place for wild swimming. In addition, St George's has ghosts among the ghosts, and there's a fish shop in the sky. All this coming your way during the next hour or so. Again, with no birthdays, but loads of news, so it's straight over to Andy.
Hi, so I have this week's news. There seems to be quite a lot of sort of crime stories, so I'm going to start with those and get them out of the way. A 22-year-old man has been convicted of murdering a rival in revenge for an earlier attack after a chance encounter between the two on a busy Norfolk Street in broad daylight. Junior Suleiman had just brought some cigarettes from a shop on St Peter's Road, just off Great Yarmouth's Golden Mile, when he spotted Filizano Jose Vieira Balde walking past. He crossed the road, pulling out a large knife from his backpack before stabbing his victim, who he blamed for an attack 1 month earlier, in the chest. Mr. Vieira Balde, 23, died in a nearby alleyway after staggering away with unsurvivable injuries. Suleiman had denied murder, but was convicted by a jury at Norwich Crown Court after a 2-week trial. The trial had been told there had been animosity between the pair following an incident 5 months earlier, when Suleiman threw Mr. Vieira Balde and another man out of a party he was hosting in the town because they were having a row. 4 months after that, Mr. Vieira Balde attacked Suleiman and stabbed him when they bumped into each other at another property in Yarmouth. Weeks later, their feud came to a deadly end on the streets of the town. The 7 men and 5 women on the jury took 7 hours and 7 minutes to reach a majority verdict. Suleiman, who had already admitted possession of a bladed article, showed no emotion as the guilty verdict was announced. Judge Alice Robinson thanked jurors for their attention to the case. She said Suleiman, who wore a waistcoat and white shirt and trousers, would be sentenced at a date to be fixed, likely to be in October. He will be sentenced alongside 2 other defendants, including James Santos, 45, of Nelson Road South, Yarmouth, who is Suleiman's uncle, who had previously admitted assisting an offender. He had admitted assisting Suleiman between February 7th and 11th last year by disposing of evidence and helping him leave the scene. Another man, Victor Silva, 22, of Crossway Turrets, Loddon, also faced his sentencing after he admitted assisting an offender. Both Suleiman and Santos fled the scene after the killing. And the next story. The police have closed their investigation into an alleged sexual assault by a man on a 13-year-old boy on a bus. The incident is said to have happened on Saturday, June the 8th, when a boy was boarding a bus from his home in Great Yarmouth to meet his friends in Norwich. He sat upstairs on the X11 first bus and was the only person on the top deck until a man got on and is said to have sat next to the boy. The man is then reported to have continually touched the boy's leg inside his thigh and even attempted to kiss the boy before he exited the bus at Acol. The boy remained on the bus to see his friends in Norwich. His mum said he was left petrified after the incident and did not report it until 3 weeks after it happened when he told a teacher at his school. As soon as his boy's mother was told, she immediately reported it to the police and she said she's unhappy with how the police have dealt with the incident. but a Norfolk police spokeswoman has said their investigations into the incident have now been closed. A statement read, "All lines of inquiry have been exhausted and the case has been closed. Of course, we would always review any new information provided to us." And news of a drugs raid in Galston. Five men have been arrested after an armed drugs police raid took place near the High Street in Galston. One of the people arrested was a man in his late teens on suspicion of intent to supply a Class A drug. He was taken to Bury St Edmunds police station, where he remains. A man in his 20s was arrested on suspicion of being concerned in the supply of a Class A drug and was also taken to Bury St Edmunds. Two men in their 30s were also arrested on suspicion of the same offence and taken to Great Yarmouth police station. Finally, a man in his 40s was arrested on suspicion of being concerned in the supply of a Class A drug and was taken to Wyndham police station. A police cordon was seen in the town while the operation was underway, and all five men remain in the stations across the region for further questioning. And I have another report which is remarkably similar, but I assure you it is different. Because two men have been charged following an armed drugs raid in Galston. On Thursday, August the 1st, officers raided four addresses as part of an investigation into the supply of Class A drugs in Great Yarmouth and Galston. Officers discovered a large amount of cocaine and cash and arrested five men who were taken into custody for questioning. Mark Kane, 41, of Coronilla Green in Galston, and Ashley Youngman, 33, of Cliff Hill, Galston, were charged with conspiracy to supply Class A drugs and appeared at Norwich Magistrates Court on Saturday, August the 3rd. They've since been remanded into custody and are due to appear at Norwich Crown Court on September the 2nd, 2024. Three other men, aged in their late teens, 20s and 30s, have been released on bail until October the 17th, 2024. And a shoplifter who attacked staff at a Tesco store when they tried to stop him leaving has been ordered to pay compensation. Paul Marriott, 38, claimed to have been paid by others to repeatedly steal alcohol from the Salem branch of the supermarket in March. Norwich Magistrate Court was told members of the public had to intervene when he had become aggressive and started assaulting members of staff when he was stopped trying to steal booze worth £225. Marriott of Bank Street in Salem, who has 12 previous convictions for 20 offences, pleaded guilty to three counts of shop theft and assault by beating. Maya Lal, mitigating, said he had no recollection of the incident and had been ashamed when shown his actions on CCTV. He has an unhealthy relationship with alcohol, she added. Magistrates ordered him to pay £100 compensation to store staff and reimburse the cost of the stolen items. He's also required to complete 15 rehabilitation days and alcohol abstinence monitoring as part of a 12-month community order. And a man was seriously assaulted after being punched in the face in a road rage attack. The assault happened between 6:30 a.m. and 6:50 a.m. on July 30th in the lay-by of the A47 before the William Arms roundabout between Galston and Great Yarmouth. The victim was punched in the face by another man, resulting in serious injuries that required hospital treatment. The suspect was said to be driving a small grey car. Norfolk Constabulary would like to speak to anyone who may have witnessed the incident or who has any relevant dashcam footage. And a burglary at a fish and chip shop in Galston. Four charity boxes were stolen during a burglary at a fish and chip shop in Galston. PJ's sits on the corner of Springfield Road and Bells Road in the town. In the early hours of Wednesday, A glass panel on one of its doors was broken and a burglar entered the building. The shop's bosses said the till was completely smashed up and the contents of the float and four different charity collection boxes were taken. They took to social media to call for any witnesses or anyone with relevant dashcam or doorbell footage to come forward. A Norfolk police spokeswoman confirmed the investigation is ongoing. And the last of this little series, you'd possibly be glad to know. A man left his ex-partner's new boyfriend with a fractured jaw and eye socket after he hit him outside his flat, a court has heard. Nathan Graver, 34, had seen his former partner walking past his Great Yarmouth flat before coming out to attack him. Norwich Crown Court heard Graver approach the victim before he punched him in the face. Samantha Lowther, prosecuting, said the victim suffered a fractured jaw and fractured orbital bones around his eye socket in the incident on September the 21st last year. Mrs. Lowther said the victim suffered a significant injury, given that two fractures were sustained. Graver of Maxis Laney Court, Regent Road, Yarmouth, appeared on court on Wednesday, August the 7th, when he pleaded guilty to inflicting grievous bodily harm. He also admitted separate offences of possession of cannabis and having an article with a blade or point, which both occurred on October the 14th last year. Mrs. Lowther said there was suggestion a knuckle duster was used in the attack and the prosecution needed time to look at whether one was used or not, as the guilty plea had not been entered on that basis. Judge Andrew Shaw adjourned the case for a mention on August 22nd to give the prosecution time to complete their inquiries, adding, "Having a knuckle duster would make a significant difference to sentence." John Morgans represented Graver. Right, that's the end of the crime, thank goodness. And a sailing story. It had become known as the Bridge of Sighs before the debacle turned into an embarrassing farce. But now, boaters who were marooned in the Norfolk Broads have finally been able to set sail out to sea after an 83-day blockade of a key river crossing ended. Great Yarmouth Haven Bridge is lifting once again after a temporary agreement was reached between Peel Ports and Norfolk County Council. This six-month truce put an end to a dispute which was triggered by drunks trying to direct traffic and staff suffering abuse when it was lifted and malfunctioned in February. The incident prompted Peel Ports to refuse to open it until the council introduced new measures to avoid a repeat of the scenes. This led to an effective blockade of the crossing, preventing river users from passing through the low-lying bridge. The matter was resolved after the County Council conceded and agreed to contribute towards the cost of running the bridge while both parties seek a longer-term solution. Members of the Broads boating community have been quick to make use of their newfound freedom. One skipper, Terry Everett, has now been able to move his 100-foot cruiser through the bridge to have it surveyed in a shipyard to ensure it is seaworthy before then setting sail with his wife Tina for their new life in Essex. The pair, who live aboard Weilau, a Prussian barge built nearly a century ago, embarked on their journey on Monday morning. They had previously been marooned in the Broads for several months due to the blockade, as their boat was too large to exit via the alternative route of Mutford Lock in Alton Broad near Lowestoft. He said, "We're so pleased it's now operating and can now enjoy our retirement. We've seen lots of vessels coming and going enjoying the freedom to leave the Broads. I'm hoping it stays that way." The ending of the blockade has also been welcomed by Peter Ward of the Broom Owners Club, a group of boaters who own seafaring vessels built at a shipyard in Brundle. Since the reopening, he has left the Broads with a flotilla of three other craft, which sailed down to the south coast. It's so important to see Great Yarmouth open again. It's absolutely brilliant, he said. While there's been excitement that the bridge is operating once again, it remains to be seen if a long-term solution can be found. Mr. Ward added, there's still a lot of anxiety about what this temporary agreement means, and we want to know what will happen in the long term. Kay Mason Billing, leader of the County Council, said reopening Haven Bridge was essential for the local economy and to restore access for river traffic. She added, we've agreed to a short-term arrangement with Peel Ports to break the deadlock and get the bridge reopened. We are in discussions to find a longer-term solution which will give local businesses and river owners the certainty they need. We're determined that the bridge will be kept functioning and remain open for those who wish to use it, and we appreciate how important this is for Great Yarmouth. A spokesman for Peel Ports said, we're happy that the County Council have listened to the issues and we continue in dialogue with them on the topic of health and safety. And another, well, sort of water item. The owner of a riverside marina has lost a second planning battle with the Broads Authority amid claims he is a victim of a personal vendetta. Raymond Horrocks has been told to remove two static caravans from Loddon Marina, which sits alongside the banks of the River Chet, following a two-year dispute. He claimed that these homes had been situated on the site for more than 20 years and were rented out to the boatyard manager and other tenants, which included homeless and vulnerable people, with whom he has tenancy agreements in place. However, the authority believed they were not of a high standard of design and took enforcement action against him in order to have them removed due to a lack of planning permission. It is one of several disputes he has been embroiled in with the authority, which also includes breaching regulations at the Beecham Arms along the River Yare, which he has also lost. A further legal battle is also ongoing at the Burnie Arms, an isolated pub further downstream on the Yare near Breydon Water. The years of planning rows have led Mr. Horrocks to claim the authority has a personal vendetta against him, an accusation that's been dismissed by the authority. Mr. Horrocks appealed to the planning inspectorate against the enforcement action, arguing there had been residential homes on the land for 20 years and it therefore should be granted permission. The government official dismissed these claims and decided there was not enough evidence to support them. It means the enforcement action has been upheld and Mr. Horrocks has been told to permanently cease keeping caravans on the site and remove the two homes from the land. Mr. Horrocks and his son William have also lost appeals relating to a workshop built without permission at the Beecham Arms, and they've been told to take down the building. And more planning. A bid to build 200 homes has left some residents in Acle asking if the proposed development is a step too far. Crocus Homes is targeting a 20-hectare parcel of land between Leffins Lane and Jolly's Lane in Acle for a scheme which would also include an independent living centre for over 55s, a country park, a community building and car parks. The houses would range from 1 to 4 bedrooms, and the independent living community would boast 90 apartments. So far, the proposals, in the hands of the planners at Broadland District Council, are facing almost 30 objections. One of those is from Acle Parish Council, which is strongly opposed to the application. It said the development is too large for the village, which in the last 12 months has seen the completion of 2 new housing estates. These are Crocus Homes 45 House, Oaks Meadow Scheme, and the Lovell Homes development St Edmund Park, which has 137 houses. The Acle Parish Clerk, Pauline James, said the Parish Council welcomed the proposal for the open space, country park, play area and community space, but felt the size of the development was too great a sacrifice for the village as a whole. Residents echoed those concerns. A person living on Peter Avenue said the proposal was surely a step too far for Acle, especially with regard to other recent developments. Another villager said, "I would suggest there is so much about this proposal that suggests it's a poorly disguised attempt to shoehorn an impractically large development into a location that is manifestly unable to support it." Chris Bennett, Senior Heritage and Design Officer at South Norfolk and Broadland District Council, also noted the size of the development was very large in relation to the existing size of Acle. He said the layout needed fundamental rethinking to create an appropriate sense of place. Slightly smaller development. Plans to convert barns into new holiday lets have been met with objections from a charity over fears it would increase light pollution and traffic. The Campaign for the Protection of Rural England's Norfolk branch has taken a stand against the bid, which would create 5 properties for short-term stays in Tunstall, a village near Acle. Developer R.J. Moore and Partners said the units at Low Farm will boost tourism and the local economy, adding the conversion will be carried out in a sustainable manner. It says the barns are currently underutilised and this would provide a new purpose for the structure. However, the campaign have objected, complaining it would have an adverse effect on the local landscape and increase light pollution, which would potentially affect the dark skies in the area. Barbara Adamski, the planning expert of the Campaign for Rural England, added the homes would also likely be car dependent, resulting in increased traffic, arguing this would make the site unsustainable. The plans have been submitted to the Broads Authority and the application will be decided at a later date.
Andy will be back in the shake of a lamb's tail, as they say. But who they are, I'm not sure. But first, there'll be spooky goings on soon at St George's. Details in the news later. So I thought that this piece from one of our lockdown weeks might be of interest. Theatres are well known for hosting plays and disappearing acts, but unexplained shadow figures aren't usually part of the script. Ghost hunters in Great Yarmouth believe they've captured paranormal activity at St George's Theatre. A video posted by Ghosted UK on their YouTube channel shows a number of silhouettes walking through the corridors next to the entrance of the theatre. Members of the group, including Tim Johnson, Annabelle Barnes and Amanda Isherwood, said that they were excited by the discovery at their paranormal event during 2019. Mr. Johnson from Caister admitted he wasn't sure what the shadow figures were, but has described them as unexplained paranormal activity. "I haven't got a clue what they are, but it definitely isn't the shadow of people, because you would have seen somebody walk in front of the window," he said. "It's really exciting and we want to go back again to explore the building further. At the minute, it remains unexplained." Mr. Johnson said the group, which was set up in January 2019, uses a variety of high-tech pieces of equipment to help with their investigations. The state-of-the-art kit includes night vision cameras, motion detectors and voice recorders. The Ghosted UK team were joined by 10 members of the public at the event, with all proceeds raised going to the theatre. The group said they also heard creepy voices. Graham Harris, operations manager at the theatre, said he thought the findings were interesting. He said, "Anything which helps to support the theatre is a good thing. The group would be more than welcome to return." Mr. Johnson believes there used to be a cellar near to the entrance of the theatre, and that is where the figures could have been walking to. "We spent a lot of time doing background research on a building to see if we can predict anything we might encounter," he said, "and a cellar nearby could explain it." Really? When we host our events, we make sure we have lots of cameras set up and monitor the CCTV closely to make sure we don't miss anything. In 2013, goose hunters from Hopton explored the theatre but found no evidence of paranormal activity. They mentioned shadowy figures, so those were the shadows with ghost riders, albeit in the sky, not a repurposed church, but it's near enough. Right, back to Andy for more of this week's local stories, followed closely by some weather news.
And news of a potential rental. An empty corner shop is available to let only 6 weeks after the property was vacated. The premises is on the ground floor at the Brian Grint Centre on the street in Acle. Until June this year, it traded as the Chocolate Box. That business has relocated to the former Wilkerson's hardware shop next to Carter's Butchers on Old Road. A listing on the property website East Commercial says the premises is a prominent corner-situated shop in a village centre. The shop would be refurbished in 2022 and, according to estate agents, would suit a variety of retail or office uses. The recent refurbishment works include new doors and windows, lighting, heating, fire detection and security alarm systems. The Brian Grinch Centre is named after a well-known local historian and parish councillor who died in 2020. The building, which was renamed at a special ceremony in June 2022, is a community hub which also houses the Acle Food Bank. And now I've a series of stories coming up about cuts. Mainly it seems to involve the County Council. And this one is cuts to disability services in particular. Cries of shame on you could be heard coming from the public gallery at County Hall this week following a controversial decision to make cuts to disability services. Norfolk County Council cabinet members voted to reduce the amount of financial support it provides to some of the most vulnerable people in the county as it seeks to make £64.2 million worth of savings from its adult social care service. The move by the Conservative-controlled authority has been criticised by councillors and was met with widespread concern among carers and disabled people who worry about how they will be affected. At a cabinet meeting, Kay Mason Billing, leader of the council, defended the decision, arguing there was no other choice and it was necessary to ensure the council avoided the risk of bankruptcy in future years. We have to make savings to keep the council solvent, so we can continue to deliver services for all residents. We cannot just do nothing, she said. This has kept us awake at night. She called for the government to step up and properly fund adult social care services in order to address the rising costs, which now make up 40% of the council's annual budget. But the cuts were met with anguish and frustration, with one member of the public crying out to councillors from the gallery saying the decision was disgusting. You can always find the money for your own pay rises though, can't you? He said. Shame on you. The minimum income guarantee that income disabled people can keep for everyday expenses after the cost of council range home care is taken into account will be reduced from £187 a week to £171.25 a week. The changes mean the council's policy is now in line with the government's recommendations for the minimum income guarantee. However, there was some relief as the council chose not to agree to an even lower rate for younger adults aged between 18 to 24. The move will save the county council more than £1 million a year. The move has caused anger among councillors, who have said it's a dark day for the authority. Stephen Morphew, leader of the Labour group at the council, said, "This is a bad decision, with known damaging outcomes taken in the poorest way after a consultation in which nobody had any faith by an out-of-touch Conservative cabinet reading from pre-prepared statements. Those same cabinet members refused to even discuss our proposals to overhaul adult social care and save money sensibly at the same meeting as they pushed through the budget." Terry Jeremy, the new Labour MP for South West Norfolk and a county councillor for Thetford, added, "It's very disappointing that the most vulnerable in society are bearing the brunt of cuts as usual." Brian Watkins, leader of the Liberal Democrat group, called the policy cruel and warned it will likely have financial implications for the NHS and mental health sector. He said, "It is a dark day for the County Council. The Conservative administration has made a political decision to make savings at the expense of our most vulnerable residents." When the Council proposed a similar reduction in 2019, it triggered a High Court challenge, which the council lost, with the judge ruling it was discriminatory. Questioned if the council has set aside a budget for any potential legal action resulting from this fresh decision, Andrew Jameson, deputy leader and finance cabinet member, was unable to provide an answer directly. Mr. Morphew believes a fresh legal challenge is likely. Doubtless the Ombudsman and courts may be invited to have a view by those affected, which will load even more pressure onto the system. I look forward to continuing to support these challenges. The suggestion that the decision is unlawful was refuted by Alison Thomas, Cabinet Member for Adult Social Care. This is not unlawful or discriminatory and will be in line with national policy, she said. And the next cuts story. Recycling centres across Norfolk are to go part-time after County Hall agreed to shut all of the facilities one day a week. The Conservative-controlled Norfolk County Council Cabinet members voted to approve this move this week in a bid to save £200,000 a year. All 19 recycling centres will be closed on Wednesdays as part of the plans, which have been reintroduced in an effort to plug a £60 million gap in its finances. Speaking at a Cabinet meeting this week, James Bensley, Cabinet Member for Environment and Waste, said the closures will bring Norfolk in line with Suffolk and will help make the service more sustainable. We have had 6 recycling centres running part-time for 10 years, he said. Visitor numbers show Wednesday remains one of the quietest days of the week. We recommend for Norfolk to match Suffolk to help prevent cross-border waste arriving. Closing on Wednesdays is one of 2 measures proposed by the council that will change how recycling centres are managed. A booking system is also set to be implemented later this year. It is hoped that this will help prevent trade waste from being dumped under the guise of it being domestic waste. The decision comes despite 62% of people who responded to a consultation disagreeing or strongly disagreeing with the proposals. People told the council they were concerned that it would lead to an increase in fly tipping, a fear that has also been raised by Green, Labour and Liberal Democrat council leaders. But Norfolk Council has said Suffolk has not experienced any increase after it introduced the measures. And the next cuts item. 1,000 streetlights are to be switched off on roads across the county as part of efforts to balance the books and find savings. Norfolk County Council Cabinet members agreed to the measure this week, which will plunge 33 roads into darkness. This amounts to just 2% of the 54,000 streetlights the Conservative-controlled council manages in order to save £200,000 a year at a time when it's faced with higher energy bills, and it would also cut carbon emissions by an annual 76 tonnes. The savings measure is one of several agreed this week, which also includes shutting recycling centres on Wednesdays and cutting income support from disabled people, as you've heard earlier. The move follows a public consultation, which revealed a number of people were concerned about the effect this will have, worrying crime rates would increase and drivers may be at a greater risk of harm. One respondent highlighted women in particular may feel less safe due to the changes. They said, "This will result in women not feeling safe out of doors at night. This means women will not have equal access to public space, as men don't often have these fears. I'm particularly worried about this as I'm partially deaf and can't always hear hazards. I rely on light." Others worried the lack of light may also result in people being at higher risk of tripping and falling. The roads which will see lights switched off are located across Norfolk and include sections of some major roads, such as the A10 in Tottenhall and the A146 in Loddon. Officials say the areas have been picked to have minimal impact on drivers, pedestrians and cyclists, and that police and emergency services will be consulted to ensure changes will not increase crime. Locally, the affected roads are in Caister and Great Yarmouth North, Caister Road, Yarmouth Road, between Caister Bypass, Yarmouth Road Roundabout, and Fremantle Road. and in Great Yarmouth South, or Bradwell, Beaufort Way between Hodds Lane roundabout and Wiltshire Drive roundabout. And in Ormsby, Scrapby Road between Yarmouth Road roundabout and 230 metres northwest of Station Road, California Road Junction, and also in Station Road from the Scrapby Road Junction. And another closure. And this one is Great Yarmouth Council rather than Norfolk Council. People have been urinating on the street in Hemsby due to a public toilets being closed. Great Yarmouth Borough Council closed the public loos at Hemsby Beach in 2016. They had then been taken on by local businesses, but that arrangement has ended. But now, during the busy summer months, there's been a knock-on effect from the closed toilets, with people said to be urinating up the back of Hemsby Lifeboat Station and on the streets. Daniel Hurd from the lifeboat station said, "It's disgusting and smelly, as well as a health and hygiene concerns. We think it will get so gross that it will stop people from visiting here. The council should be in charge of the public toilets and ultimately do more to help trade thrive down here. It's a disgrace they expect us to manage the loos. Where on earth does our council tax actually go? The community here depends on tourism thriving, and the beach has been absolutely packed this summer, but if this continues, it could deter visitors." The lifeboat is hosting a fundraising event this weekend, and they've been told they will have to arrange for portable toilets to be provided at a cost. Mr. Hurd said, "We have been told that to open the toilets we have to pay out of our own pocket, which seems absurd, as our money is for saving lives and protecting the community. It seems so unfair they expect us to pay for a solution to the toilets being closed, but considering it's a mess they created by closing them, I don't know why they aren't paying. The knock-on effect could be so great and detrimental here, and to think they have abandoned responsibility makes us so angry. The beach has been rammed with visitors, which is amazing, but the council don't even pay for it to be cleaned either, anymore. That falls to volunteers. Previously, there were issues of people vandalising the toilets and teenagers smoking cannabis in the loos. Great Yarmouth Borough Council says that local businesses can get in contact with it to discuss opening the toilets under their own management. A spokesman said, "Great Yarmouth Borough Council closed the beach toilets in 2016 following a review of services. Since then, the public conveniences have been operated by local businesses. This arrangement has since stopped. But if anyone wishes to open and operate these toilets as previously, then they can contact us to make the necessary arrangements. Any organisation running a local event must make their own assessment of the need and provision for toilets." The Reform MP for Great Yarmouth, Rupert Lowe, has been emailing the Borough Council, urging them to take action and reopen the facility under its own management. He says he's still not had a reply from the Borough Council. In a statement shared on Facebook, Mr. Lowe said, "I've been informed by the Hemsby lifeboat crew that a number of people have been urinating on the station. Absolutely outrageous behaviour, but we must get the public's toilets open ASAP. I've emailed the council leadership again, asking for urgent action. It's an incredibly important time of the year for Hemsby businesses, and not having any available public toilets is having a number of unwanted consequences." As we said, last summer the toilets were open and managed by local businesses. Mr. Hurd added, "For the council to expect businesses during their busy season to have the money and time to run the public toilets is so ignorant. We're all fighting to help the community, and when we're really busy in the summer months, the council should do more to support us." And another closure story, albeit a bit different. And Christchurch in Great Yarmouth is to close down. For the last 170 years, a church in the centre of Great Yarmouth has been a refuge for people in the town. Christchurch, an imposing 19th century building on King Street, survived two world wars and two global recessions. But next month, the congregation at the 170-year-old Methodist chapel will gather for the last time. The decision follows a decline in attendance, the cost of maintaining the building, and a three-year-long parking dispute with Norfolk County Council. Until May 2021, visitors to the church could park on the building's forecourt with a permit. But that month, signs were put up on the land by Norfolk County Council stating that parking was banned on the verge or footway. Since then, the building's project manager, Andy Ingram, has warned that the future of the building was at risk. And the 62-year-old has now said the parking ban was one of the main reasons for the closure. There used to be space for 26 cars in front of the church, he said, but now there are only 6 spots, which discouraged people from attending. A spokesman for Norfolk County Council said, "The area in front of the church was redesigned 15 years ago as a pedestrian space with restrictions that prevented parking, and this was preceded by double yellow lines." Mr. Ingram, who's worked at the church since 2009, will retire after the final service on August the 31st. He said, "I'm sad because they're all friends here and we'll all be split up. It's not going to be the same. The building means a lot for the town. It's a focal point. It's a community hub. There's nowhere else in the town like it." The church sees an average of 30 people attend its Sunday services, while the congregation's youngest member is 61 years old. Reverend Andrew King said the closure was a consequence of some members not coming back after COVID, and to an extent, not having the parking at the front. "It's hard to maintain a building of this size with a small congregation. It's unmanageable," he said. Mr. Ingram said the church cost a small fortune to run, with bills for heating up to £1,000 a month in winter. After the final service, the congregation will be able to attend the chapels in Newtown, Gorston, Bradwell or Caister. The church building itself is divided into two, with the chapel on the first floor and the ground floor dedicated to meeting rooms. Last December, its cafe closed down after 30 years. Currently, the church is used by 26 groups, including Alcoholics Anonymous, the Great Yarmouth Civic Society, and the University of the Third Age. Hugh Sturzacre, chair of the Civic Society, said, "It's one of the few places left you can hire for meetings. It's very sad. It's sad when people can't meet other people face to face." Mr. Ingram said the meeting rooms will stay open for community groups after August 31st, but added, "But I don't know for how long." Among those who will attend the church's final service is Margaret G, 93, who has played the organ there for the last 60 years. When she joined the church in 1961, it had 200 members. "It was a community space," she said. "Lots of people came in there, but the parking ban stopped a lot of people coming to the church." Of her weekly recitals, she said, "I just enjoyed it. I just say it's a God-given gift, and I've got to use it in his service. I'm just so very sad. I'll have to find somewhere else to go," she said. And a bit of background to the building. Christchurch was built in 1854 and was known first as King Street Congregational Chapel. The Congregationalist community moved out of the church in 1930 and the building was sold to the Methodists, who renamed it Methodist Central Hall in 1938. In the 1950s and 60s, during the height of the herring season, the church would be packed with Scottish fishermen. The Great Yarmouth Methodist and the United Reformed Churches then united in 1990, and the Congregationalists returned, and the building was renamed Christchurch. The first Methodist church in Great Yarmouth opened on October the 28th, 1783, with the service attended and overseen by the movement's founder, John Wesley. This is not a current report, nor is it a forecast. It's a recollection of the day when fish rained from the sky. on 6th of August 2000. A very, very strange thing happened in Great Yarmouth, which few people, it seems, know about or remember, but perhaps you do. It wasn't the fact that there was a rainstorm that day, but that when the rain fell in one area of the town at least, it was accompanied by a host of dead sprats, enough to completely cover one shed roof. Yes, that may sound like I'm trying to pull your leg, but I'm not. Such events, involving not just fish, happen quite regularly around the world and are well documented. This one is specific to Norfolk and the sort of human interest story that our regional newspapers, like the Mercury, love. But just to explain briefly, the Met Office said at the time that such occurrences are not as uncommon as they may appear. Not only are they not miraculous events that deliver rains of fish for the table, but even more surprising objects such as frogs, tomatoes, and even lumps of coal. They even provided the inspiration for some of the events of the 1999 Paul Anderson film Magnolia, which went to the extreme of having a diver fall from the sky. Thanks also to the Met Office, their explanation was expanded to say, given strong enough winds, along with thunderstorms for example, small whirlwinds and mini tornadoes may form. When these travel over water or land, any small items of debris in their path, such as fish, frogs, desert sand, etc., may be picked up and carried for up to several miles. Sooner or later, the crowds carrying them will open and drop their strange cargo. Hence the hail of fish, frogs, or whatever the winds happen to have picked up. These weird rains are not limited to Britain, by the way. Indeed, they've been recorded all over the world and throughout the ages. Even Pliny the Elder, writing in the 1st century AD, mentions storms of frogs and fish, so nothing, it seems, is new. Some believe that these events may also give a clue to the origin of the plague of frogs recorded in the Book of Exodus. But enough of this general explanation. Let's return to the tale of Great Yarmouth and to the small group of terraced houses about half a mile from the seafront, which was the epicentre of this rare but not unique phenomenon in August 2000. A keen witness there was a local gentleman whose words were penned at the time by a local, and possibly very excited, newspaper reporter. Never mind the weather stories about the drought of 76 or the gales of 87. Fred Hodgkins, a retired ambulance driver in Great Yarmouth, has a tale about the day it rained fish. When Mr. Hodgkins, 65, first heard the thunderclaps over his terrace house on Alderson Road yesterday, it seemed to be just a routine rainstorm, if a little heavy for the time of year. Then he heard what sounded like hailstones drumming down. And according to Mr. Hodgson at the time, there were a couple of claps of thunder and the sky went really dark, even though it was only about 11 a.m, he said. At first I thought something might have gone wrong with my eyes, because the whole of my backyard seemed to be covered in little slivers of silver. When I looked again, I saw scores of tiny silver fish. I got more neighbours to have a look, because I knew nobody believed me. One of them had their garden shed covered in fish. It was quite extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it before in my life. In this case, it seems the tornado gathered over the sea, and the fish got sucked up into the clouds. They were obviously carried along in the cloud for some distance before the cloud burst and the fish fell with the rain. The end.
The Weather Girls and It's Raining Men, given the paucity of raining fish songs. OK, time for the rest of this week's local news from Andy.
A shop in the parade of shops leading up to Haven Bridge on the South Town side of the river could serve alcohol until 2 a.m. after a licence application was approved. Great Yarmouth Borough Council. I'm going to apologise to this gentleman if he ever hears this, because I'll never get this name right. Thandalthapani Murugadas's application for permission to serve alcohol at a business called South Town Convenience Store. The licence granted permits the sale of alcohol from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m. between Sunday and Wednesday, the sale of alcohol between 8 a.m. until midnight on Thursday, and 8 a.m. till 2 a.m. on Friday and Saturday. The address on the licence application was given as 9 South Town Road, Great Yarmouth. There were no objections to the licence being granted, the council have confirmed. The deadline for any objections to be lodged was July the 29th. Back to car parking. The Market Gates Shopping Centre in Great Yarmouth has introduced a whole new car parking system and changed charges. The centre made the changes at the start of the month and has a new ANPR system called Horizon Parking to monitor the car park. It allows shoppers to pay with a card, contactless, and by cash. In addition, it accepts prepayments. The parking rates have changed slightly, costing £1.20 for up to an hour, £2 for up to 2 hours, £3 for 3 hours, and £4.20 for up to 4 hours. Among the stores within the shopping centre are Boots, Superdrug, Trespass, Starbucks, Burger King, Poundland, JD Sports and Pandora. The centre's open 7 days a week. From Monday to Saturday it opens from 9 a.m. till 5:30 p.m. and on Sundays and bank holidays the shopping centre is open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. However, the car park opening times are slightly different. From Monday to Saturday, the car park opens from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. And on Sunday and bank holidays, the car park opens 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And back to boating stories. Broads Authority have given warning of navigational changes on Breydon Water. And the Broads Authority has issued a map showing the changes it has made to the channel markers on Breydon Water at Great Yarmouth. Some markers have been removed, including the cardinal mark at the end of Turntide Jetty, while others have been added to help novice boaters navigate through the area. A yellow post is in place to mark the corner of this structure. The Broads Authority said that vessels should ensure that the changes are taken into consideration for passage planning and when navigating in this area. It is hoped this will make the channel easier to follow for novice boaters. A spokeswoman for the Broads Authority said, "Most people will not notice the change, but we go through the formal process of notifying users even for the smallest of changes." The additional channel markers are between the existing markers, again, to help less experienced boaters follow the channel. And a story of someone, apparently a larger-than-life character who always said he wanted to appear at his own funeral. And John Calthorpe's wish was granted when family and friends brought a cardboard cutout of him to a celebration of his life at the Pier Hotel in Gorston. Mr. Calthorpe, who died in February at the age of 97, was a former police sergeant and one of the people behind Crime Stoppers, which was first set up in Great Yarmouth in 1983. His daughter, Tricia Miles Crust, said he had always wanted to be at the celebration in person, and the best we could do was a life-size cutout. Mr. Calthorpe was born on August the 6th, 1923, in Southtown in Great Yarmouth. He attended Edward Wordledge School and the then Great Yarmouth Grammar School. In 1942, during the Second World War, he had his appendix taken out, and when the call-up came for military service, he was enlisted in the Home Guard. After the war, he did various apprenticeships before joining the police, a job which saw him oversee some of the emergency response to the devastating East Coast floods of January 1953. He also met his future wife, May, in the early 1950s and was later promoted to police sergeant. Those were the heydays of Great Yarmouth tourism industry. Sometimes, when all the B&Bs and hotels were already fully booked and holidaymakers couldn't find anywhere to stay, they would go to the police station to ask about accommodation. Some of those visitors ended up staying in Mr. Calthorpe's family home after a quick phone call home to his wife. When he retired as sergeant, he remained with the police in a civil role and was part of the team which launched the first ever Crime Stoppers service in the UK. The crime detection scheme was set up in June 1983 by Detective Chief Inspector Michael Cole of Norfolk Police and Jim Carter, manager of the town's Woolworths. Mr. Calthorpe would call local businesses to raise money for the service and also helped to set up the computer system. "He really enjoyed the job," Miss Miles Crust said. "He was always very proud of Crime Stoppers because it was successful." After Mr. Calthorpe retired, he enjoyed playing lawn bowls in Gorston and whist with his fife. He also travelled as much as he could, and his last trip was to South Africa when he was in his early 90s. He baked cakes up to last year and must call his granddaughter for advice about recipes. Miss Mars Crest said that her father was generous, family-oriented and very chatty. "He would have enjoyed this celebration of life. He really liked meeting new people and liked being around family," she said. The celebration saw 45 people, including family, friends and some local police officers, gather at Maud's Bar in the Pier Hotel. They then scatters his ashes on Gorston seashore. In unpublished memoirs, Mr. Calthorpe wrote about his experience during the Great Floods of 1953. He was enjoying a weekend off when the flooding started, but as soon as he learned of it next morning, he went to one of the worst hit districts, low-lying Lichfield and Cobham. He was wearing civvies because when he left home, he was unaware that the scale of the problem meant he would become heavily involved. Despite not being in uniform, he commandeered boating late rowboats from Gorleston and council lorries and carted them to Southtown. Over the following days, he helped evacuate hundreds of people from their homes. "I found my work during this disaster was one of my rewarding periods of my career," he wrote. "The public and all the services I came into contact with were wonderfully cooperative. People only wanted organising and they would do anything to help." And a rescue story. A team embarked in an operation to save a deer in need of urgent help on the Norfolk Broads. The Chinese water deer got into trouble while trying to cross a river near Reedham. The mud and silt lining the river had built up around the deer, leaving it unable to move. Luckily for the man, onlooker Cal Callaby spotted the deer just in time and called Marine and Wildlife Rescue. Mr. Callaby, along with help from a Broads ranger, managed to wriggle the deer free and help it onto the safety of the bank. On Facebook, he said, "The poor thing was exhausted. Its head kept dropping in the silt. But the Broads Authority ranger was great. No way could I have got it out without his help." A spokesman for Marine Wildlife and Rescue said, "We have many intricate rescues called into our charity across Norfolk. They require careful planning and often multi-agency involvement." Another Gorleston story. A defibrillator has been installed in dedication to the late Gloria Doyle at Fish Quay at Gorleston. The apparatus installed on July the 30th was funded by her relentless fundraising efforts as chairwoman of the Great Yarmouth Seamen's Trust. And alongside its installation, a plaque was unveiled. A cheque was also given to Pat Hollins for the Fisherman's Hospice in memory of the Trust chairman. Heart to Heart Norfolk took part 2 making the life-saving device fit for use 24/7 via The Circuit. The plaque was donated by Global Engraving. Another water story. A Norfolk lake has been named as one of the 20 best places to go wild swimming. Fritton Lake, which sits close to the Suffolk border, was included in the ranking by The Telegraph. The article said, "Swims here are exclusive to cabin owners, members and holiday guests, which may undermine the spirit of wild swimming somewhat. That said, the holiday resort has a lake that's fit for rural royalty." It also commented on the sport's excellent water quality and the site's truly inspiring 1,000-acre rewilding project that has filled the nearby wildland and forests with a diverse range of species. This is not the first time Fritton Lake has attracted attention in the national press. In May, The Guardian named it as one of the UK's 10 most tranquil holiday spots. And in 2023, the March yoga retreat held at Fritton Lake was included in a list of the best yoga retreats in the UK and Ireland for 2023 by Condé Nast Traveller. It also scooped a TripAdvisor Traveller's Choice Award in 2022. And, well, an invitation. The public is invited to a special service marking the anniversary of VJ Day in Great Yarmouth. This traditional Thanksgiving and remembrance service will commence at 6 p.m. on Thursday, August 15th, at the Far East Prisoner of War Memorial on Marine Parade. And VJ Day marks the surrender of Imperial Japan in August 1945, ending the Second World War. This day carries local importance, as many men from the borough served in the Far East during the war. The Far East Prisoner of War chaplain, Pauline Simpson, BEM, will lead the service. A period of silence will be observed for 2 minutes, followed by a wreath-laying ceremony. Great Yarmouth's Mayor, Councillor Paula Waters-Bunn, will be present to lay a wreath on behalf of the borough. Councillor Waters-Bunn said, "VJ Day is a worldwide day of remembrance for the Far East prisoners of war. This year and every year, we invite the people of the borough to join us as we remember the price they paid for our freedom. And members of the public are welcome and should arrive by 5:50 p.m. for a 6 p.m. start." As if we didn't start with enough horror stories of crime, we've now got a horror story of its own. A popular horror film festival gears up for its third consecutive year with famed participants. Saturday, July the 27th, sees the return of the 50 Years of Classic British Horror Festival at St George's Theatre in Great Yarmouth. This annual event has been a success since its inception in 2023. Over the past 2 years, it has boasted appearances by horror fan favourites such as director Lawrence Gordon Clark, Sergei Sobotsky, son of legendary Amicus film producer Milton Sobotsky, and Swedish actor Britt Ekland. This year's special guest, Caroline Munro, is respected in the genre and has appeared in many well-known horror and fantasy films such as The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter, and the James Bond movies The Spy Who Loved Me. Al Friswell, a restorer chosen by Ray Harryhausen for the preservation of monster models used in his film, will talk about his experiences with the master animator. Screenwriter David McGillivray, known primarily for his work on exploitation horror films like Frightmare and The House of Whipcord, will also be participating. Rejoining the festival are favourites like Madeline Smith, who appears in the Hammer film Frankenstein and The Monster from Hell, and Phil Campbell and Brian Reynolds. The festival also promises to present Paradelia, a modern horror film featuring Graham Cole, a former star of the bill. The festival organiser, Celine Paxton-Brooks, said, St George's Theatre continues to be a great venue to show much-loved horror films. Now in its third year, 50 years of classic British horror has become a popular annual event. It's wonderful to bring vintage films like Frankenstein and The Monster from Hell, as well as guests from in front of and behind the camera, to enthusiasts in Norfolk who might not always get the chance to experience events like this. And tickets are still available to purchase at St George's Theatre. And perhaps a less frightening event. An innovative family walk combining history and technology is debuting in Great Yarmouth. The Fresh Approach, a Great Yarmouth Heritage Guide, employs an app to engage families during the walk set for August the 18th at 10 a.m. Called Seaside Adventure into the Past, it starts at the Carlton Hotel on the seafront with a trained guide leading the way. The much-favoured action-bound app allows participants to delve into the rich past of the town. The tour intertwines an absorbing audiovisual journey with an informative guided tour. Short films featuring voices from the past and an interactive quiz make the walk vivid and engaging. The action-bound app is included in the guiding walk to add another dimension of entertainment and interactivity to the family outing. The walk, targeting families with children aged 8 and above, lasts roughly 1 hour. It concludes at the Williamson's Old Penny Arcade, part of Merrillville Model Village, where children are entertained with vintage slot machines. Tickets priced £4 per person, with advance booking required via heritage-walks.co.uk. And with a bit more entertainment, a local community centre is marking its 75th anniversary with a Summer Fun Day celebration. Galston Shrublands Youth and Adult Centre has grown into a popular and well-used community hub, offering comprehensive activities, advisory services and abundant opportunities. Established in 1949, the centre offered a breadth and depth of activities, including physical training, table tennis, music classes and discussion centres. The centre was converted from a farm, and by the early 60s its membership reached 2,000, with an annual attendance of 75,000 at the centre. The centre provided a vast array of stage shows by the Shrublands Drama Group, along with advice from different organisations, including the Citizens Advice Bureau, which launched in January 1951. Originally owned by the Education Department of Great Yarmouth Borough Council, and then by Norfolk County Council, the centre has undergone considerable changes. The Shrublands Community Trust, a charity now operating the community centre, continues to offer enriching and diverse opportunities. The Summer Fun Day on August the 10th starts from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m, features games, stalls, walking football, face painting and a car boot sale, among many activities, and is free for all attendees. Organisers say this celebration feels particularly special as the centre continues to provide services similar to those offered at its inception. The centre boasts of high attendance with weekly visits by thousands and has managed to remain a central part of the community. The centre today offers social events, sports and health activities, advisory services and houses a range of services including the Community Food Club, Community Cafe, Shrublands Health Centre and many more. And the Shrublands Community Trust collaborates with partners to provide these services. And now, like all the best news items and organisations, I'm going to finish with the weather. In particular, you may have heard of Storm Debbie. A tropical storm currently wreaking havoc in the USA could play a part in creating hotter temperatures in Norfolk this weekend. While the forecast for the rest of this week remains fairly changeable, come Saturday, conditions will start to feel more humid, with Sunday and Monday expected to be the warmest days. An increasingly hot and humid air mass will push across the southern half of the UK, bringing the potential for heavy rain, especially in the east from Monday. The influence felt by Storm Debbie, which has brought extreme rainfall to coastal Georgia and South Carolina, will be felt indirectly in Norfolk, although through its influence on the jet stream, a fast, narrow current of air that flows in an easterly direction very high across the globe. The Met Office chief meteorologist, Dan Suri, said, "Tropical Storm Debbie in North America is helping to strengthen the jet stream and causing it to meander over the Atlantic. This will allow hot air to move into the UK later this weekend and early next week. While parts of the south and southeast of the country could reach 30 degrees C, areas of Norfolk, such as Dereham, Thetford and Norwich, are set to see highs of 28 degrees C on Monday."
Well, that's it for this week's edition, which is copyright 2024 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Don't forget, you can contact us from our website at grapevinegy.org if you have any queries over our service. Your newsreader next week will be Margaret, so we hope for your company then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all at Grapevine, stay safe and well, enjoy Storm Debbie, whatever she may bring, and bye for now.